TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Cows and the American West. Welfare Ranching.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged sky and up a cloudy tall.
The mythology of the American West shows rugged cowboys chasing stampeding herds of cattle. Hollywood movies and advertising for banks and cigarettes show almost always the same landscape, the fragile wildlands and deserts of the American West. Since the introduction of cows into the American West and Southwest, first by the Spanish and then by Anglo settlers, an environmental catastrophe has unfolded that affects rivers and springs, indigenous plants and trees, wildlife, including eagles and songbirds, bears, bighorn sheep, wolves, coyotes, and elk, even bats and prairie dogs. The area of land that is damaged by grazing in the West is simply staggering. Most of it is public land, 300 million acres, equal in size to three Californias. The National Public Lands Grazing Campaign says that taxpayers subsidize the environmental destruction of the American West with $500 million per year. And they have crafted legislation to buy out the federal grazing permits of ranchers. This radio program gives an insight into their campaign. George Werthner is a wildlife biologist and has worked for the Bureau of Land Management and other agencies on many of the areas he's describing. He spoke about the impact of grazing on wildlife, plants, and water in the first part of the program. Now he makes the point that livestock production affects an additional 200 million acres. Corn, soy, and hay have to be grown to fatten cattle for slaughter. Here is George Werthner.
Then, going beyond public lands, just to sort of get this into a broader contextual framework, almost all livestock, well, I'm talking about cattle in particular, these days are fed, some finished off with crops, particularly crops like corn, soybeans, and so forth. The single greatest crop that we grow is corn, and this is 70 million acres here was harvested, 80 million acres were planted. California is 100 million acres, 103 million acres. So imagine everything in California from, say, Redding south to the Mexican border, from Nevada to the Pacific Ocean, nothing but a cornfield. That's how much land we use to grow corn that's fed to livestock. But that's not the only crop we do. We also grow soybeans, of which, despite tofu and all that stuff, 95% of all soybeans goes for animal feed. And we planted 77 million acres last year. 77 million acres. So we've got 80 million acres and 77 million acres just in those two crops. And then hay of all types. They harvested, but planted considerably more, but harvested 61 million acres. Oregon is 60 million acres. All of Oregon, from the Pacific Ocean to Idaho border, Washington to California, nothing but a hayfield. I mean, we're talking about impacts. You start putting this forage together, and it's all going for livestock feed, and you start thinking about how much land is affected, you'll find that between the lands that are grazed, the lands that are pasture, the lands that are crops that are grows, in my estimation, I've tried to add these things up, though nobody accounts for them specifically that way, and it's about 70% of the land area in the lower 48 states that's used for animal agriculture. And to put that into perspective, all the urbanization in the country, talking about all the cities, the highways, the malls, affects 3.5% of the country. a really significant impact on the landscape has to do with agriculture, but most of the agriculture is for animal agriculture, and most of that is for livestock. So when you go across the middle part of the country, and I just drove it on the way to Vermont last year, and when you're going across Nebraska and Iowa and Illinois and Indiana and Ohio, this is what you see for mile after mile after mile, and unrelenting. So I have a final thing, as you know, I've sort of alluded to it. Housing tracts and so forth are a big impact. They fragment habitat. They introduce weedy species. They affect wildlife. They are a source of pollution and so forth. And in places that are growing around the West, like California, you're really familiar with, most of the people in the West live in urban areas, so we see this stuff all the time. So we're aware of these impacts, and we should be. And we try to do things about them and try to prevent these things from where they occur through zoning and through conservation easements and so forth. But we practically ignore the much larger effect on the West of livestock production. You can see when you look at a map of the West, it is grazed or affected by livestock production. Now, the degree on any particular acre may not be the same, but when you look at the cumulative impacts, as I've tried to point out, and you figure that that's happening on hundreds of millions of acres, it becomes quite significant. Of public lands in the West, Nevada is the fastest growing state right now in the West. In fact, I think in the country. And so if you look at the impacts in Nevada, you say, what's impacting Nevada? I mean, Las Vegas is not a pretty sight. But in terms of what's affecting the state as a whole, livestock production is far more serious menace to the biodiversity in Nevada than that urbanization. And I'm not saying the urbanization isn't something to be concerned about. I'm just trying to shift the focus so that we focus on both of these things as issues. Of course, the ways to deal with the urbanization, we have things. We have zoning and planning. We have conservation easement. We can outright fee purchase to protect this habitat. But we haven't dealt effectively with the livestock production and how to limit that. And I would submit to you that eliminating livestock on most of the public lands in the West, if not all of them, would have significant benefits both for the land itself as well as for taxpayers and the subsidies that we would avoid direct, as well as the indirect externalities. Because one of the ways that livestock producers in the West compete elsewhere is that a lot of their impacts that I just talked about, the impacts on water, the impacts on soil, the impacts on wildlife, and so forth, are not really paid for by themselves or the consumers that use ultimately the products produced. And things like having viable elk herds, if you talk about what's a more important, I mean, just from sheer economics, what produces more money just for elk hunting, for example, if you wanted to do something like that with the forage that's on public land versus cattle or wildlife watching or whatever. These have all been shown to be economically more important just from a pure economic, not to mention the ecological services provided by clean water and intact riparian areas and so forth. So, you know, I have this vision of what the West could be like. And I'm not saying it's going to go back to what it was when Lewis and Clark went there. We've gone past that point. We can't go back to that. But we can certainly get a lot of areas restored where we can have things like, you know, bison and elk in a lot of people's backyards, if very close rather than just distant things in the distance, where we can have streams that are filled with trout and salmon, where we have streams that flow in the summertime instead of drying up, and where we can restore things like wolves to the landscape across the whole West. And so this is the kind of the vision that I see as an alternative to the present livestock production use of these lands. And particularly on public lands, we have a say on that. And that is something where we can influence the management. And I at least feel that given the uncertainty of what's happening on private lands and given the fact that trying to get a coordinated kind of focused management on private lands is very difficult given the way this society is, our public lands are one of the few places where we can save a lot of endangered species and provide a habitat for them and where we can preserve ecological processes. And so that's why the focus on the public lands and why I think it's critical that we eliminate or at least seriously reduce the number of livestock on public lands, because in that one thing we can do more for wildlife and biodiversity in this country than just about anything else we can do so easily, affecting so few people for so little cost. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
That was George Werthner, wildlife biologist and co-author of the documentary book, Welfare Ranching. Andy Kerr has a congenial attitude and an ability to get his message across to ranchers and corporations and to Republicans and Democrats alike. He directs the National Public Lands Grazing Campaign and has helped craft legislation to pay ranchers to give up their grazing permits in return for what he calls a golden saddle. Here's Andy Kerr.
Thank you all for coming. George has painted a picture that suggests that those little livestock aren't just kind of benign out there in the old pastoral setting. For the federal lands, which are hundreds of millions of acres that are grazed by livestock, the fee paid by the cattle industry who have those permits to graze those public lands is set this year by an archaic formula that makes no sense, of $1.35 per month per cow. So $1.35. It costs people more to feed their gerbil than that a month. Now, in contrast, if it's private land or state land, not federal land, the average fee in the West is about $12 per animal unit month, this cow and a calf for a month. That's quite a disparity. I mean, you know, if that rancher was having to buy forage on private lands, you'd pay about $12, paying $1.35, so there's quite a subsidy there. Now, to provide that subsidy, to give that rancher that $1.35 to keep his cow and a calf out there for a month, it costs the taxpayers, it's called you and me, over $30 to provide that cow and a calf for a month. So there's this huge, massive subsidy from the federal government, $500 million a year, conservatively estimated, to subsidize livestock grazing on the public lands. This is, I'm just talking the fiscal impacts, not talking the environmental impacts. These subsidies are so much that some conservationists and others are proposing that federal permittees who want to go simply be paid a generous amount, sort of a golden saddle kind of thing, to leave peacefully. This has been done in certain areas using private funds, but because it's such a pervasive problem on federal lands, we need federal dollars. That basically suggests that in exchange for generous compensation, these permittees waive their interest in a federal grazing permit, and the forage is reallocated to wildlife and watershed and things like that. We're getting a bit of interest from the cattle industry, not the industry per se, but many of the individuals in it, because we are proposing that they get paid well over four times the average market value of their grazing permit. If you own a ranch, that ranch value that has those federal grazing permits associated with it, that value is inflated to reflect the fact that if that ranch sells, the next owner is dead certain going to get those federal grazing permits, get that $1.35 per animal unit month grazing. So there's a value in the property associated with that. So we're proposing they be paid, on average, 4.5 times the market value. So you go, well, wait a minute. Why should the taxpayers have to pay for this, and especially at an inflated value, when it's the taxpayers' grass? Well, the fact is we're in a political hole. We are, as taxpayers and citizens, spending $500 million a year, and we don't have the political power to get out of that. Sort of one of these things that Congress does every year. So the last time I checked, money still talked. And there's also a demographic thing going on here. A majority of cattle permittees in the West will change hands in the next 10 years because they're getting old. Some of them are huge corporations like Anheuser-Busch and Disney Corporation and J.R. Simplot. Others are mom-and-pop grazing operations, many of which they're approaching their 70s or past the normal retirement age. They love the lifestyle, but they have kids that ran away from home 40 years ago. And they're not coming back to run the ranch. The economics are with foreign beef imports. The fact is that only 1 out of 5 cattle operations in the West have any federal grazing permits. So most cattle grazing and livestock production in the West isn't associated with federal lands, even though a huge acreage is. It takes an average of 14 acres of public lands in the West to keep a cow going, cow and a calf, for 1 month. 14 acres for a month. So that fat cow is out there working, looking for the grass. In contrast, it takes 2 acres per year to grow livestock in the East, east of the Mississippi. 81% of all the cattle forage, livestock forage in this country is east of the Mississippi River. So when you got to talk about acres per cow rather than cows per acre, you're probably not in the right part of the cattle business. But it's a lifestyle they love. They get to wear the big belt and the buckle, and we as a society mythologize cowboys. You know, I've been watching the World War II. Many Europeans are calling George Bush a cowboy. And that's a pejorative term in Europe, that he's, you know, off shooting his six guns and whatever, not whatever we do in Hollywood movies. But it's that phrase may work in Europe, but it doesn't work here because we mythologize cowboys and ranchers. But the fact is, the economics are changing. Foreign beef imports, differing food options and things like that. So cattle business isn't particularly good to be in. So we're suggesting that on their way out the door, if they'd like some generous compensation in exchange for the allotment that they were using on public lands being permanently retired from livestock grazing, they would get a generous permit. There is precedent for this. I'm sure you're all quite intimately familiar with the peanut quota buyout. Oh, really? Not? I didn't know about it either until we had these attorneys who gave us some technical advice on how these buyouts, if they happened, would be treated for tax purposes, because a lot of ranchers asked that question. There was a peanut subsidy, and you had this quota program, and you if you had this subsidy, you got a certain amount the government would pay for peanuts, regardless of what the market price was. And this is not unknown in the agricultural industry to have subsidies like this. But the government finally decided, well, you know, this is ridiculous. We're just going to buy them out. So they gave them a lot of money to end the peanut program. It was still a great deal for the taxpayers because of these ongoing subsidies. So there is legislation going to be introduced in Congress. There is some interest in the administration of doing something like this. There are other bills introduced in Congress that are going to be introduced because livestock grazing on public lands is becoming an issue. It hasn't been. I worked a bit on old-growth forest issue, and, you know, I could take somebody out and show them an old-growth forest, and you show them a clear-cut right next door, and they kind of go, yeah, I get it, you know, this is... One feels right, one feels kind of wrong. But as George was pointing out, because livestock grazing is so pervasive around the West, it's hard for people to imagine to see what areas could be like without livestock. So the conservation community is continuing its effort to list species under the Endangered Species Act, to litigate under the Clean Water Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act and other laws to put a dent in livestock grazing. But as that great environmentalist Sun Tzu said over 2,000 years ago in China, he wrote a great book that all environmentalists should read called The Art of War. And he said, if you corner your enemy, make sure they have an escape. Because if you corner them and they don't have an escape, their only option is to try to kill you. And so if you're not quite sure that you're going to kill them, you want to give them an escape. And so we are proposing generous compensation, and it's getting interest. We did a mailing to 25,000 federal grazing permittees. We had their names and addresses as a matter of public record, so we sent them a letter. It's causing quite a lot of interest. There are those, one permittee called me up and said, yeah, my neighbors are all talking about your letter. They're dividing into two camps, he said. He says, yep, there's those of us who would like to be able to sell our federal grazing permits, and there's those of us who don't want our neighbors to be able to sell their federal grazing permits. But this is not a divide and conquer strategy. It's a divide strategy, but we anticipate converting a majority of federal land grazing permittees to our side. Not because they are born again environmentalists who go, oh my God, what I've been doing has been horrible. That isn't the case. They're going, well, I'm out of here. You know, the world's changing. It's becoming more difficult to graze public lands for environmental reasons, for economic reasons, for demographic reasons, and all these things. And so they're looking for a golden saddle on the way out the door. One permittee in Idaho called me up, and he felt he needed to tell me he'd take that buyout, but everything, for all my reasons of wanting that buyout, I was totally full of shit. And so one of the things he said was, not really in a rhetorical question, but he said, cattle ranchers, public land grazers are great stewards of the land, and they take care of it, and if they're not out there, the land would self-destruct. I don't know exactly but what would happen, but he said, quote, hey, this is after he said he takes the money, he says, if ranchers aren't out there every year cleaning out the springs with their bulldozers, who's going to? I admit I had no answer to that. I don't know who would be cleaning out the springs with their bulldozers if it wasn't the ranchers. And I don't think there'd be a particular need to be cleaning out the springs with the bulldozers, but I don't have to go there with him. We didn't have that discussion, because all we have to agree on as environmentalists and certain public land grazing permittees, that if they're ready to go, that in exchange for generous compensation, they ought to get generous compensation, and the grazing permit ought to be permanently retired. So that's a proposal in Congress that Congress is going to be taking up. They're going to take up some other proposals. The administration is proposing rulemaking changes to, if you thought it couldn't be any easier, this administration is trying to figure out ways to make it even more easy to graze cattle on the public lands with less restrictions. And so it's an interesting time. We have, you know, hundreds of millions of acres at stake in some of the most environmentally fragile landscapes that few people relatively know about. But we have some really interesting things going on. Demographics, economics, fiscal issues, environmental concerns are all converging, that it's quite possible that public land grazing reform, such as I'm outlining, will be one of the few areas that the conservation community is on the offensive in Congress. For the most part, we're on defense. But there's some possibility, because of the unique political dynamics I've suggested to you, that we will be able to move this legislation. In Arizona, we also anticipate that unarguably the most liberal member of the Arizona delegation, and probably one of the more liberal in the United States Congress, and one of the probably the most conservative member of the Arizona delegation, even though there are so many in the running for that title, they both like this voluntary buyout idea. So that's what we're up to. We're going to see more attention on public land grazing. We're going to see more litigation and listings, but we're also going to see perhaps some congressional action.
That was Andy Kerr. He and the wildlife biologist George Werthner were recorded in 2003 at the launching of the large documentary book, Welfare Ranching, The Subsidized Destruction of the American West. In preparation for this program, I called Andy Kerr and asked him how he had progressed in bringing his legislation into Congress. He told me that national legislation has been introduced, as well as a bill for the state of Arizona, as well as legislation concerning 1 million acres of grazing permits in central Idaho. The national and Arizona bills were introduced in October of 2003 and had 25 co-sponsors. The Central Idaho bill was introduced in October 2004. They have been referred to the House of Representatives Resources Committee. None of these have passed yet, but Kerr is optimistic. All three bills will be reintroduced into the new Congress in January 2005. I asked Andy Kerr why it was necessary to go the route of national legislation.
Legislation will pass only if it has the support of the conservation community and a critical mass of ranchers who want it. There's a lot of support in the conservation community. Some organizations are hung up on the principle of why should the taxpayers pay for something that these ranchers don't legally own. It's sometimes the case that excessively principled opposition to an injustice can get in the way of ending that injustice. Giving ranchers a golden saddle is ecologically imperative, it's socially just, and it's politically pragmatic. It's the right thing to do.
That was Andy Kerr. We spoke in December 2004. He directs the National Public Lands Grazing Campaign. Their website is www.publiclandsranching.org. That's publiclandsranching.org. There is a link on the newest programs page of TUC Radio's website. Andy Kerr and George Werthner were recorded at the release party for the large documentary book called Welfare Ranching, The Subsidized Destruction of the American West. Ghost Riders was sung by Johnny Cash. You can find more information on cows and the American West on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get a one-hour tape or CD of the program on welfare ranching, cows, and the American West by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 1-877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.